ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He's worth more than $1 billion. Christopher Skase buys Warwick Capper for the Brisbane Bears.
He paid me the most cash because I was the best player.
But
Skase was essentially a hustler and a huckster.
And he gets away with the biggest corporate crash in Australia. I'm Mark Humphreys. Search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon, on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, this is Geraldine Doog here, and welcome to a bit of a different episode of Global Roaming, because I had the chance to sit down with two very, very experienced observers of their own country, the United States. Susan Glasser, she's currently the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, but with an enormous amount of experience in the Beltway, and her husband, Peter Baker, who's chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. They were here in Australia to deliver the annual Lowy Institute's media lecture. And it was terrific to be able to sit down face to face with them at the moment when so much seems to be in flux in the United States, to the point where it feels like the democratic foundations, quite frankly, of the country are being tested. Certainly a lot of people outside the US are saying that. And as usual, you know, it's been a busy week in the US. And we spoke on the cusp of some of the bigger developments, the military meeting at the Pentagon, the shutdown of Congress, and of course whether Trump's peace deal for Gaza would be accepted by Hamas. So it was great to get some much needed context. And without further ado, here is my extended chat with Susan Glasser and Peter Baker. Peter and Susan, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, we're delighted to be with you.
Now, we're speaking to you at a time when we're seeing President Trump significantly step up his retribution campaign, I think you could call it. I think he even uses that word, retribution, to imprison, fire, or otherwise silence those he sees as his foes. I wonder, with all your history behind you, how you both describe this moment in American political history. To you first, Peter.
Well, it feels like an inflection point, to use a phrase that was very popular in the last administration, a point where America may be turning into a very different kind of place. You know, in the New Republic, they wrote recently that America is no longer a democracy. Didn't say that it's become an authoritarian state, but that it's something less than a democracy. Whether we agree with that or not, there are clearly things that this president is doing that hadn't been done by a previous president, certainly not on the scale and scope that he is doing. He has accrued to himself power that no other president has had. He has turned the instruments of power against his foes. And I think the question for a lot of people is, where is this taking a country that had a long tradition of institutions that
checks and balances.
Now feel fragile.
I mean, Susan, with your experience behind you, are you personally frightened about where this is headed? The caveat is, I think looking on from Australia, and you'll discover we're totally fascinated by what's
yes.
happening, possibly unnecessarily. It often seems as if a lot of Americans are quite sort of insouciant, almost complacent about this. And people from outside, people like Garry Kasparov, for instance, you know, the chess man who's trying to alert people to slides to autocracy, are much more concerned than the average American or even the totally educated, involved American.
Yeah. Well, you know, Peter and I served as foreign correspondents in Russia just a decade after the fall of the Soviet Union. We were there for the first 4 years of Vladimir Putin's now quarter century of rule. And I think one of the reasons that you're seeing Garry Kasparov and others having been so clear-eyed from the beginning of this Trump period in American politics is because we've seen what that authoritarian playbook looks like when the effort is to roll back democracy. Now, thank goodness, the United States is a very different country with a different history than Russia. We certainly have 250 years of democratic small-d institutions. There are big questions, as you pointed out, about the checks and balances in our Constitution, whether they're functioning right now. But we also have a tradition of federalism in the United States, which is perhaps the biggest difference than the highly centralized authority in Russia and other countries of the former Soviet Union. And, you know, we have a divided country. It's not easy to take over the entire United States when 50% of it is vehemently opposed to Donald Trump and what he's doing.
Vehemently opposed?
Yeah, vehemently opposed. Donald Trump is a historically unpopular president of the United States. And I think it's very important for Australians or others outside of this to recognize that this is a minoritarian movement. Donald Trump right now has among the lowest approval ratings in history. The only person who's ever had lower approval ratings is he himself in his first term in office. And, you know, roughly about 40% of Americans right now support what Donald Trump is doing. But again, he's governing as if he is all powerful.
Yeah, put it this way. If we're saying, is there a slide towards autocracy, you don't have necessarily have to have tanks in the streets, do you,
right,
to have autocracy. What I wonder what for you would be crossing some line that really worried you, Susan?
Yeah, look, let's be clear. We've crossed many lines. January 6th, to be clear, was the most shocking moment of my adult life in terms of the United States. You know, probably only watching what happened on September 11th that as an American, you know, was anything comparable to it. And that's the difference between an external threat and our country ripping itself apart from within. And, you know, the fact that Donald Trump was reelected after essentially encouraging and inciting a mob of his own supporters to storm our own capital, the visual representation of a country that is tearing itself apart. And that's the big observation for me, my perception about what's so radical about this second term of Donald Trump that I think is really important to point out for people. He himself told us this agenda. It's about retribution, but it's also about going after Americans themselves, the enemy within, he calls it. There's an interview that he gave in October of 2024, right before the 2024 election that he then went on to win, in which he was asked about America's foreign policy if he returned. And he said, well, yes, we have adversaries like Russia and China, but then we have the enemy within. And of those, the enemy within is the greater threat. And I think he's organized his administration and radically changed the notion of American national security to focus on what he calls the enemy within.
That's what's so interesting by comparison with, say, the McCarthy era, Peter, is that during the McCarthy era, there was a distinct enemy without the Soviet Union.
Right.
Now, I wonder whether, you know, that actually gave him, McCarthy, temporary power that actually Donald Trump won't have because there isn't an external enemy.
Yeah. What's interesting, though, of course, is that McCarthy wasn't president. And what we have now by having a person, you know, playing that role in the Oval Office is a different beast in a way. McCarthy sent a chill of fear through a lot of Americans, obviously had the bully pulpit of the Senate. But he didn't have the Justice Department. He didn't have the FBI. He didn't have you know, the pen that can sign executive orders. And we've seen this president in the last 8 months, he signed orders directing the government to investigate former aides because he's mad at them for turning on him. He has taken away security clearances from dozens, scores of people because they were investigating Russia's interference in our election. He's fired FBI agents and career prosecutors because they prosecuted the January 6th
rioters. He's pardoned the rioters.
Exactly. And he pardoned the January 6th rioters. He's punished law firms that dared to hire people that he didn't like. He has done more than any single president to insert himself into
national
life. Now,
are you sure? Can you, I mean, looking back, because obviously there's a lot of checkered parts of America's political history.
Absolutely.
Are you sure nobody else has been quite so
outside of wartime, obviously. You know, during the Civil War, obviously, Lincoln had you know, assumed great power, suspended habeas corpus, shut down newspapers, and so did, obviously, Woodrow Wilson during World War I and so forth. There have been times during war when you've seen presidents extend their power in ways that would attack free speech or dissent. But certainly in the modern era, certainly in generations, we've never seen anything like this. And we've never seen it at a time when a president had as much power as the current presidency does have, and that he has built around himself with a compliant Congress and with courts that are willing to go along on a lot of this stuff.
Look, it strikes me that in so many ways, Trump is behaving in a way that's the antithesis of the mainstays of conservative ideology in American history. And this is something that some parts of the MAGA establishment openly celebrate. For example, let's hear now Rachel Bovard from the Conservative Partnership Institute speaking earlier this month at the National Conservatism Conference.
Before we begin, I wanted to follow the example of a recent DNC summer meeting by opening our time together with a land acknowledgement. Please bow your heads. We acknowledge that we are gathered here today on the traditional lands of the Republican establishment, who opened borders, started wars, and betrayed working families here for generations. We remember their contributions to globalization and tearing down the sovereignty of our country and its people, and solemnly commit to never listening to them about anything ever again.
Now, look, you've both been shaking your head. I was quite shocked when I heard that.
Yeah.
What do you make of it, Peter?
Well, the truth is MAGA, Trumpism, is not a Republican movement. It's a right-wing populist movement, maybe, however you want to define it. And they targeted the Republican establishment almost as much as they target the Democrats. It was about taking over the Republican Party, right? Trump didn't – he's not a long-time Republican. He was a Democrat. He used to be a member of the Reform Party. He switched parties six times, I think, over the course of his life. He's not about party politics so much as his own movement, that he took the Republican Party and basically hijacked it and has now redefined it. And redefined it along the lines of a very different ideology than Ronald Reagan's conservative ideology. It is not against globalization, whereas Reagan was for free trade. It is against internationalism when Reagan, of course, led alliances. It is against immigration, not just illegal immigration, but even a lot of legal immigration, whereas Reagan, one of his most stirring speeches, was about the value of immigration in America. He has redefined what it means to be republicanism, and they are at war with the old establishment.
So if the right, well, the implication you're saying is that the right is quite divided, Peter, underneath it all, whether they speak out, doesn't that make the whole project of Trump a bit brittle?
Well, I mean, divided in the sense that there are plenty of Republicans, particularly office holders, who don't agree with Trump, but they're not willing to say it. He dominates his party in a way I've never seen any president. I've been covering the White House going back to 1996. I've never seen Democrat or Republican, a president able to enforce discipline, loyalty, whatever word you want to use, the way that Donald Trump has. And that he's done that through fear and through retaliation, retribution. Republicans who dare to disagree with him on things have been basically ostracized and exiled from their party. Think about Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, Adam Kinzinger, all of these people who are no longer Republicans, or at least no longer in office as a result of daring to disagree or to dissent. So he can. It's a divided Republican Party, but you wouldn't see it on the surface because, in fact, they're not allowed to air those differences. And I think that he's actually managed to push a lot of Republicans who didn't agree with him at first to go along with his point of view.
But is it bubbling underneath? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Less than it used to. I think less than it used to. I think that people like Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, you know, these other people who used to be considered hawks, for instance, on Russia, they've actually begun increasingly to buy into Trumpism, because that's where they see the Republican Party going, and that's where they see their future.
I mean, when you talk like this, you think of the Deputy Chief of Staff, Stephen Miller, speaking of somebody who certainly uses the language in a particular way. He's been emerging lately.
You cannot defeat us. You cannot slow us. You cannot stop us. You cannot deter us. We will carry Charlie and Erica in our heart every single day and fight that much harder because of what you did to us. You have no idea. The dragon you have awakened, you have no idea how determined we will be to save this civilization, to save the West, to save this republic.
I mean, who is this man? He sounds unhinged in the way he speaks about somehow defending an American sort of, it's almost going back to the very founding origin story or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you brought up Stephen Miller, because I think he's one of the major powers behind the throne in Trump 2.0. And, you know, you talk about divisive. He's one of the people who joins Donald Trump in calling his enemies the scum of the earth, human scum who should be eliminated. And in fact, he actually uses a very eliminationist rhetoric when it comes to immigrants. He's long been sort of the architect of Donald Trump's anti-immigrant views. Remember that Miller, who's now the Deputy White House Chief of Staff and is exercising what we understand to be an enormous amount of sway over both Trump's foreign and domestic policy, even though formally speaking, he's his chief domestic policy advisor and homeland security advisor. Miller has been with Donald Trump from the very beginning. He was...
Who is he? I mean, he just, to me, he suddenly emerged as this incredibly powerful person. I thought, where does he come from?
Yeah, no, I mean, he comes from Donald Trump land, and he was a young Capitol Hill advisor to the very first senator who endorsed Donald Trump back in the 2016 election campaign. That was a name you probably haven't heard in a while. That was Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, who went on to become Donald Trump's first attorney general until Donald Trump fell out with him over his recusal from the Russia investigation. Well, Stephen Miller switched carriers, if you will, and has been probably the most loyal companion and ideologue.
Is he from the South?
No, he's not. He's from a liberal family. Including a family of Holocaust survivors in liberal Southern California. And there's a lot of people who think that it's his own grievance with growing up in a liberal Beverly Hills that led him to this career as a right-wing agitator. And he is in a position of enormous power now.
I've just got to stop you here because, I mean, this is really gobsmacking in a sense. And it leads me to almost questions about the psychology of both Trump and people like Stephen Miller, because that just sounds completely contradictory.
Yeah, look, in Miller's case, he grew up in high school at the time of 9/11 and was... affected by that, and very, very contrarian with his liberal classmates who didn't, in his view, show enough support for cracking down on Muslim immigrants. It became very performative, even in high school, trying to force the high school to have a Pledge of Allegiance every day. And when they didn't, he reacted to that. And he comes out of this grievance of
reaction to a huge shock.
Exactly. It's a grievance kind of politics, right? And Trump is also about grievance politics. And, Miller has been the ideological sort of foundation for Trump, who's not a very ideological person himself. Miller fills in the lines with policy. Trump knows that being against immigration is good politics. It's where his instincts are. Miller's the one who comes up with a specific policy saying, how do we get rid of temporary protective status for these people? How do we get rid of, asylum seekers? How do we get rid of, all these different rules that allow people to stay in the country? And he's been given enormous power. He has been given enormous sway because he understands how to make the system work for Trump.
Hello, Geraldine Doogue here, and you're listening to an extended conversation with two venerated journalists, Susan Glasser and Peter Baker, for ABC Radio National's Global Roaming program. Still to come, Peter and Susan's advice for Australians who are trying to come to terms with the age of Trump. I wonder if this could all go too far. That's one of the questions I heard Ezra Klein just slightly tilting at the other day in a conversation with David Remnick. And that, in fact, he was pleading for the left to start doing lots more alliances to build up a broad church, like a coalition. We're very used to that here in Australia. Yeah. It seems to me that that's something that doesn't get discussed as much.
Well, in our two-party system, in effect, there already is a coalition. That's what the Democratic Party is a coalition of different interest groups and priorities and a pretty broad spectrum from, very progressive, farther left politicians such as Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to centrists like the former President Joe Biden. But, you're right that the Democratic Party is having a soul-searching moment right now because there isn't one sort of consensus view of how to oppose Trump. Back in the first Trump term, I think there was a more unified idea of what was called the resistance at that time. Mm-hmm. There was an idea like, hold the line, fight, 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 and we can survive 4 years of Trump, but not eight. Well, now we're in the eight-year cycle, there's not consensus.
He was pleading, Ezra Klein, for much more political thinking, politicized thinking, clever transactional deal doing in order to get this consensus you're talking about. He also said no Democrat should talk about 2028 and the presidential election. All the focus ought to be the midterms at the end of next year. Now, do you agree with that, Peter?
Well, I mean, look, that's a traditional view of a party is to not get past the election you have right in front of you. In fact, there are actually elections next month, some off-year elections that are really the first priority for Democrats, showing that they have some power to...
They don't sound as if they've got much, I'll tell you.
Well, no, they don't.
Down
here. They don't. You're right, they don't. But there's a good chance that they win the House. That would be the historical norm. The question is whether it means anything, right? Would that do anything? Would that represent anything? And I think that what's important to remember is that Trump isn't acting like a normal president who uses Congress to enact his policies. In fact, he's doing the opposite. Every other normal president comes in and says, I want you to pass this in my first year or two because that's when I'm most influential. He hasn't asked them to pass anything other than tax cuts. Everything else he's doing through executive power. So even if the House changes hands, it may not mean that much in terms of agenda. He may still use his executive power to override Congress on defunding priorities that they would like to fund. We've seen him basically ignore Congress.
How strong are those, though? I've heard people saying that they haven't been used much in American history.
Those aren't powers.
It's not clear he has those powers. No. That's exactly the point, is that Donald Trump is asserting to himself. It's not that he's claiming powers that other presidents were just weak and didn't claim. It's that he is actually defying someone to stop him. And that, I think, is the situation that we're in. The name Richard Nixon really hangs over a lot of this. In some ways, Donald Trump is the fever dream reincarnation of Richard Nixon. But after Nixon was essentially booted from office in disgrace, Congress passed a law, the Impoundment Act, which actually sought to stop future presidents like Donald Trump from doing exactly what he's doing, which is saying, I'm not going to spend this money that Congress has appropriated for a certain measure. Basically saying, screw you, I don't care what that law says. Until someone stops me, I'm going to ignore
Congress.
But
it could go to the Supreme Court in theory.
It will go to the Supreme Court.
It will go. Well, is there anybody on the other side, on the Democrat side, who's got anything like this sort of personality, even if it is slightly cult-like, who could counter Trump? If this is what's abroad at the moment in America.
This is the problem for the Democrats. They don't have a leader, right? They have a vacuum of leadership. They have a number of people on the bench who may eventually become leaders, become the person who can lead them out of it. But it's right now, as Susan said, I mean, they don't agree on anything. Right now, the problem for the Democrats is they don't know who they are, they don't know why they lost, and they don't know how to win.
Well, what happens then? That's a devastating little diagnosis.
I think they would agree with that because they don't have a theory of the case that they agree on, right? They don't agree that the liberals say they lost the election because they weren't liberal enough, and the moderates say we lost the election because we were too liberal. And you know, they don't agree on how it is that they lost, therefore they can't come up with a prescription on how to win.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, let's be clear that in our system, you know, there's no leader of the Democratic Party, no single figure, because that's not the system that we have.
It's not a parliamentary system.
Exactly.
I understand that.
I feel like, you know, there's... if you look at the country again, you know, we have a wildly unpopular U.S. president. You know, no American political party that I'm familiar with in my adult lifetime has ever agreed upon, you know, why they lost the previous election and how they should, until, you know, that's the process of the primaries and the debates that ultimately kind of comes to some conclusions, right? That's how we sort of work out those internal fractures and fissures. Certainly the Republican Party in 2016, when it scored this incredible upset, did not have a consensus on, you know, why they had been defeated by Barack Obama. In fact, their own party's conclusion about what they needed to do to win back the presidency after two terms of Barack Obama was an autopsy conducted by Reince Priebus, the then chairman of the Republican National Committee, that said it needed to become a much more diverse party, much friendlier to immigrants, much friendlier to Hispanic voters. And that's exactly the opposite of the strategy that Donald Trump successfully pursued in 2016 to win elections. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not saying that there's not a crisis inside the Democratic Party, because I actually think that there is, for some very real reasons. And part of it is I don't think they're masters of this particular radically changed communications and media environment in which Donald Trump has proved to be
Zora
so
Mandani,
successful.
Mamdani has certainly mastered that, hasn't he?
Well, that's exactly right.
So far.
And so there will be, you know, very conflicting views that you get. Peter mentioned our upcoming off-year elections this November. So you'll have this very far-left socialist who appears to be leading by a very large amount in New York City's mayoral race, Mamdani. Republicans are going to be eager to make him the new face of the Democratic Party in the United States. They're going to say the Democrats are wild, dangerous, crazy, communist, Marxist. You can't trust them. And that, you know, Republicans will be the one who will be puffing that up. But at the same time, there are these gubernatorial elections in both Virginia and New Jersey in which very kind of conventional centrist, national security oriented women, former members of Congress, Mikie Sherrill from New Jersey, my home state. She's actually from my hometown of Montclair, New Jersey. And then Abigail Spanberger, Congresswoman from Virginia, both of them veterans of the U.S. military. And, you know, they represent a very different face of the Democratic Party than Mamdani. And we'll see which side of that wins out ultimately.
So, I mean, I wonder really, finally, what your advice is then to Australians trying to come to terms with the age of Trump and whether it is symptomatic of something more. I think that's the important thing to say. Should we just sit it out and hope that America restores itself somehow or other, which we're often being told, by the way, by, I can remember, John Bolton told us that on Global Roaming earlier this year. And look what's happened to John Bolton. You know, that it sort of, and it restores its position on the global stage, or should we really be thinking in a totally different way? First to you, Susan.
Yeah, I mean, look, I have, you know, thought for a number of years that the, in many ways, and this is something actually that the Japanese national security advisor said way back at the beginning of Trump 1.0 to a friend of mine, you know, I come to Washington, he said at that time, because this is the epicenter of global instability and I need to understand what's happening here. And I think that is a frame that's important for the U.S.'s many friends and allies overseas to understand. You know, what's happening in the United States is in many ways an inward-looking sort of war within, if you will, but it has these enormous geopolitical implications. The instability of the United States is that it's a country that is divided against itself, that can't decide, you know, on its internal policies or its external policies. Donald Trump has had a very clear record throughout his time in public life of a marked preference for engaging with America's adversaries and a real distaste for long-term engagements with allies, especially with multilateral agreements, whether it's the Quad or AUKUS or NATO. He's a skeptic. And, you know, this is a man who believes that the European Union was literally created in some conspiracy to screw the United States of America. And so, you know, this is something that does require, I think, understanding among America's partners and allies that we might not be, you know, the fixed North Star that you would hope us to be. But I would also say this. What's happened in the U.S., you know, since Peter and I returned from being foreign correspondents in Russia and watched Vladimir Putin destroy Russia's very nascent democracy, is an essentially an internal conflict and a playbook that could be run anywhere, including in Australia, including in other democracies. We've seen it happen in some of the democracies in Europe. And I just think it's a cautionary tale to think about your own democracy as well, because in many ways, that is the root and the source of international power, is your strength as a society.
Yes, that's a pretty dramatic thought, Peter, for Australians, I think, to hear. But final thoughts. Can I just say, before I ask you that, the last time you were both here, you said 7 years ago that you used to wake each other up every morning since in the first term and say, what has he done today?
Yeah.
Now, are you still doing that?
I try not to wake anybody up anymore because you'll never sleep. It literally is a 24-hour nonstop cycle of news. And that's actually what's important to remember, is that this is not Trump 1.0. What we thought in Trump 1.0 was it was a cascade of extraordinary news stories and actions. And actually, it turns out that he's managed to top that in the second term. In the first term, he didn't really know what he was doing because he had never been in public office or the military before, the first American president never to have had that experience. So he was still trying to figure it out. He had people around him who tried to stop him or guide him toward what they thought would be wiser, more legal, more constitutional policies, and away from things that they thought weren't. he doesn't have those people around him anymore. And they have had 4 years out of power to plan for what they would do when they did come to power. And they have been much more systematic, much more methodical, much more rigorous and disciplined about the program that they have taken. So yes, we are waking up every day with something else happening that we might not have expected before. And we're going to sleep with something else that will have happened that would have been surprising.
So forget about restoration then, should we, Australians?
Well,
restoration of the America we knew, and
I don't think there's a snapback. I don't think the minute Trump leaves office, whenever that is, that America suddenly becomes what it was pre-Trump. The Trumpism will continue regardless of whether Trump is there. It doesn't mean that there won't be a cycle in which, you know, things change. Remember, as I just said earlier, he's not doing legislation. So everything he has done through executive order can be undone through executive order. The culture, though, the culture war will continue. And where America is heading in a broader sense, I think, is still undetermined.
Peter Baker and Susan Glasser, that was a bracing but fabulous discussion. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Susan Glasser and Peter Baker talking about the source of instability at the moment, which is the United States. Now, if you'd like to share any of your thoughts, though, please feel very welcome about this or any episode. Email us at global.roaming@abc.net.au. Well, look, I'll be back with Hamish next week for another episode of Global Roaming. Have a good week. Till then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.